Hello again, everyone, wherever you may be, and welcome to KGY Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Welcome, Laura.
Good to be here, Dennis.
Laura, the big news off the top of this broadcast is abortion. It is again legal in Iowa, up to 20 weeks of pregnancy, at least temporarily. All this after a Polk County judge this Monday afternoon, just hours ago, blocked the state's new law that had banned abortion after about 6 weeks. It has been an absolute whirlwind, no question about it, and we have it all covered. And no, we're not going to forget to talk about all those presidential candidates who poured into Iowa last week. But first, Laura, the decision this Monday afternoon by Judge Joseph Seidlin to temporarily block enforcement of the state's 6-week abortion ban, the one that Governor Reynolds had just signed into law last Friday and which the state legislature had passed last Tuesday. How did this all come about, Laura? What grounds did the judge use?
This all moved very quickly. If people are wondering how it could happen so quickly, the Planned Parenthood and Emma Goldman Clinic filed the lawsuit last Wednesday. The governor had not yet signed the law yet, but she had announced that she was going to sign the law on Friday. And so the hearing, I was at the hearing on Friday afternoon. They were able to have a hearing. It was actually ongoing while the governor was at the ceremony where she was signing the bill. So the grounds were that to temporarily block a law from being enforced while there's litigation, the plaintiffs have to show that they have standing to challenge the law, that they would be irreparably harmed if the law were allowed to go into effect, and that they are likely to succeed on the merits in court. And Judge Seidlin ruled that it's, first of all, that the plaintiffs have standing to sue. They are obviously going to be affected, that they would be, individuals would be irreparably harmed if they were prevented from obtaining abortions while this law was enforced, and also that they were likely to succeed, that this was a violation of the Iowa Constitution's due process provision. The lawsuit actually cited three different articles in the Iowa Constitution. He looked at one of them and said they're likely to succeed on this due process claim, and therefore I don't need to look at the other claims right now. And that is because he said that the Iowa Supreme Court has established this undue burden standard. Remember last week we talked about this undue burden, which is a balancing test that balances the state's interests versus pregnant people's interests, and then rational basis, which would be very likely to uphold the law. But the Polk County judge said a lower court cannot change the standard of review. The standard of review in Iowa right now is undue burden, and this law cannot survive the undue burden standard because it basically prevents abortions before most people even are aware they're pregnant.
Does that mean that the state Supreme Court, when it eventually gets this, and it's going to get this one way or the other, do they have to use the undue burden standard, or could they use rational basis?
That's a great question. They do not have to use the undue burden standard. The Iowa Supreme Court has the authority to independently interpret the Iowa Constitution. And in that ruling from 2022 that we discussed last June, where five justices of the Supreme Court overturned that abortion rights precedent from the court in 2018, three of them said, we're leaving the undue burden standard in place for now. The parties can litigate what they think the standard should be. We don't prejudge what we're going to decide when a case gets back to us. But for now, it's undue burden. Two of those justices would have immediately just declared rational basis as the standard, but that they did not have a plurality. So it was this three justice plurality that set undue burden as a standard. And there is a little bit of a dispute about whether that's correct. This took up a lot of the time at the hearing where the state was saying, no, undue burden isn't the standard. It never was the standard. But the lower court judge said, look, I have to follow the Iowa Supreme Court precedent. And what I have, the controlling ruling, is this ruling from June of 2022, where three justices said undue burden for now. They can, the plaintiffs and the state can present evidence on what standard should be used to look at this abortion ban. But ultimately, only the Iowa Supreme Court can say, we're going to use rational basis review.
Now, while the judge issued an injunction against the 6-week law, he allowed today at the same time the State Board of Medicine to go forward with writing administrative rules to govern the law's potential eventual implementation.
Yes, and this was that the state requested this at the hearing last Friday. They said that the 2018 law that was very similar, almost identical to what was just passed last week, The Board of Medicine never adopted rules pursuant to that because that law was enjoined, then it was permanently enjoined. It was never appealed for 3.5 years. And the state said, if you should decide to issue an injunction, which of course they were arguing against, but they said, should you do that, please write the injunction carefully to allow the Board of Medicine to go ahead and write these administrative rules. And that way, if the Iowa Supreme Court later reverses this ruling and says, no, we think this law should be enforced while the litigation proceeds, at least the rulemaking process can proceed. The rules are very important because this law has some vague language about medical emergencies and fetal abnormalities that are incompatible with life. And there are a lot of different scenarios that could potentially qualify for that. Also, there's some talk about permanent organ impairment, permanent health damage. So the Iowa Board of Medicine is going to need to adopt rules that spell out lots of different scenarios. When somebody presents in a pregnancy and there's this situation, is this an exception where a physician would be allowed to perform an abortion? And so that rulemaking can proceed. I have asked the Iowa Board of Medicine what's their approximate timeline for this, and I have not heard back.
You could tell the judge's distress with this. He noted in his decision this afternoon that there are, and I'm quoting, good, honorable, and intelligent people morally, politically, and legally on both sides of what he called this upsetting societal and constitutional dilemma.
And he made similar comments on Friday during the hearing. The attorney, Peter Eam, who was representing Planned Parenthood and the Emma Goldman Clinic, they had asked the judge to just issue a ruling right there from the bench. That would be highly unusual in this kind of a case, but just to not even write out a decision, but just issue a ruling immediately from the bench, temporarily blocking the law before the governor's signature could really take effect. And the judge said, I'm not going to do that. This matter deserves my serious and lengthy consideration. There are a lot of issues raised here. I'm going to need to take the weekend. He said, don't expect a ruling over the weekend. I'm going to try to rule by the end of the day, Monday. But this raises some very serious issues. And he said, just imagine how your clients would feel if I just flippantly, he used the word flippantly, ruled from the bench after hearing these arguments.
So what today's decision means, and it's a whirlwind, is that abortion, which was until Friday at about 2 o'clock, legal up to 20 weeks in Iowa, then illegal after 6 weeks in Iowa for about 72 hours once the governor signed it. It is again today legal up to 20 weeks and Planned Parenthood clinics in Iowa have appointments scheduled for tomorrow.
Yes. And I was on, there was a virtual press conference this afternoon after the injunction was issued, and the head of Planned Parenthood in North Central States, that's the affiliate that includes Iowa, she confirmed that people who have appointments can go forward with those appointments starting tomorrow. They have patient navigators who were making hundreds of phone calls last week to people who had appointments scheduled. They were able to move some appointments up. The Emma Goldman Clinic was doing the same thing. They were able to try to redirect some patients to go out of state. They stayed open extra late on last Thursday so that they could see more patients before the governor signed the law. But starting tomorrow, they can be back at their normal operation.
And when we say tomorrow, we are live on Monday night. We are talking about Tuesday. All right. What happens next legally, potentially? What could happen now?
Well, the first thing is the state has to decide whether they're going to appeal this order issuing a temporary injunction and ask the Iowa Supreme Court to dissolve that and allow the law to be enforced while the litigation proceeds. And I think the state has 30 days to file a notice of appeal. If they do appeal, then for some period of months, I mean, the Iowa Supreme Court will decide whether to hear that appeal of the injunction. Then there would presumably be oral arguments scheduled. So that could delay things quite a bit. That will be the first clue on whether Supreme Court Justice Dana Oxley, who recused herself from the most recent abortion case, whether she decides to participate in this one. You'll remember we talked about this before. Her former law firm based in Cedar Rapids represents the Emma Goldman Clinic in Iowa City, which is one of the plaintiffs in this lawsuit. And so Justice Oxley recused herself from the other case, but enough time has passed. She's not currently with the firm when this lawsuit was filed. And so it's unknown whether she would participate in a decision. But that is going to be the first big thing. The Iowa Supreme Court would then decide whether to allow the law to be enforced pending litigation. But either way, the case would go back to lower court and a Polk County judge will hear the case, will hear evidence. There will be much fuller briefing and oral arguments on all of the three constitutional claims that the plaintiffs have raised against this law.
So we're talking about a process that's going to extend at least months.
Yes, and I think that that's a real question. I mean, I do expect the state to appeal this order issuing a temporary injunction, but the one argument for them not to do that is that that adds several months of delay. And if they don't appeal to the Iowa Supreme Court, that it's possible they could get things moving along. The case could be heard in Polk County District Court sooner, and then that verdict, whatever it is, will be appealed up to the Iowa Supreme Court sooner. So, but I do expect, I mean, the governor's statement was a little bit ambiguous. She said, I will fight this all the way to the Iowa Supreme Court, but it wasn't clear whether she meant the lawsuit over the merits of the claims or this particular temporary injunction blocking enforcement of the law.
And you've just pretty much summed up what the governor said in her response to this. Democrats had the response you would expect. They say they are relieved that the district court blocked the law, that it gives women control again over their own lives. Predictable responses on both sides.
Yes. And I have to say that when I was at the legislature last Tuesday during the special session, there was a lot of discussion of why does this bill have an immediate effective date? The 2018 law had the usual 90-day effective date. And this one calls for the Board of Medicine to adopt rules, but said it will go take effect immediately on the governor's signature. And there was a lot of talk about that. And honestly, some people took a cynical viewpoint that for the majority party, that it would be better almost for them, even though they would complain about an injunction, it might be better for them if the law is not immediately enforced and people might not even be aware. And this litigation could stretch on beyond the 2024 election, but with basically a status quo policy on abortion and perhaps a lot of people unaware that this law was even passed.
We are not going to go over how the law was passed because we did that on our live Wednesday broadcast. We've gone over that several times, but we're going to summarize briefly abortion again as of Monday night. Legal again in Iowa, up to 20 weeks of pregnancy. This after that whirlwind we all went through last week. The governor signed into law the new restrictive abortion ban on Friday, just days after the state legislature had passed it. It's been crazy. I know it's difficult to follow, but the bottom line is abortion is legal up to 20 weeks of pregnancy. And my question now, Laura, is what possible impact might all of this upsetting stuff have on the GOP in Iowa next year, election-wise?
I want to say one thing, that the governor complained that life was protected for only a few days. She waited 2.5 days to sign the law. She wanted to sign the law at that family leadership summit by the family leader organization. She could have signed it first thing Wednesday morning, and she did not. So what possible impact might it have on the GOP? I think that the Republican lawmakers, the legislative leaders, wanted to get this out of the way. They wanted to not have to deal with this during next year's regular legislative session. One big question is, will they pass a constitutional amendment, put that on the ballot, a constitutional amendment on whether there's a right to abortion in the Constitution? I tend to think that they are not going to pursue that for next year. I think that they're going to try to focus on more tax cuts, perhaps, and some other issues, and try to not have the focus be on abortion during that session. I think certainly Democrats who are running for the legislature and other offices, this is going to be a very big issue for Democratic candidates in their campaigns.
I agree with you. I think that putting it up for a vote of the people might be disastrous for Republicans in Iowa, as it has been in other states.
Yes, and it failed by about an 18-point margin in Kansas. That was a referendum last August. And then in Kentucky, they had a referendum on the ballot last November, coinciding with the general election, that was very similar wording to what Iowa's constitutional amendment would be. Kansas and Kentucky both being more Republican-leaning states than Iowa, and it went down to defeating Kentucky by about a 5-point margin. And I just tend to feel, I asked the family leader, which was involved in drafting the wording of the constitutional amendment a few years ago, and I asked their spokesperson whether they are still pushing for the legislature to get that on the ballot, and I didn't really get a clear answer from them. So I am getting the strong impression that they don't want to roll the dice. The people, the faction in Iowa politics that would prefer to ban abortion doesn't want to roll the dice of having this on the ballot and having it voted down.
It is 14 minutes after the hour, and this is KHOI's Capital Week with Laura Bellin and me, Dennis Hart, your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa. We are here every week at this time and sometimes at other times to talk about what's been happening in and around the state capitol and what it all means. Yes, Laura and I have been going live a lot lately with the abortion issues going on here, but we're still strong, aren't we, Laura? We're still energetic.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the most important laws of the decade, frankly, that the legislature is going to pass.
Of course. Capital Week Caucus Almanac. Oh, gosh. A lot of Republicans came into Iowa last week, and they were all running for president. It was at the Family Leadership Summit. Actually, half a dozen came in. In Des Moines, former Fox News personality Tucker Carlson, one of your favorites, Laura, emceed the thing. Six presidential candidates showed up. He interviewed them to a crowd of about 2,000 people, and they reacted depending upon what he asked. First of all, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, well, he praised Governor Reynolds for signing that abortion law.
I want to first just clarify, I did ask the Family Leader Organization on what basis were these six candidates invited and not the other candidates? And they said that they chose the people to be invited months ago before most of them had officially announced, and that their goal was to invite national voices. It was never their goal to invite anyone and everyone who was running for president. And they also said this was intended to be an educational, not political event, which I thought was a strange statement because it was definitely a very political event. So six candidates were invited, all six accepted, of course. Ron DeSantis, yes, Tucker Carlson gave him a chance right away to talk about the abortion issue. He praised Governor Reynolds for signing the bill. He mentioned that he signed a similar six-week ban in Florida. And he didn't exactly say that he would want to sign a national six-week ban, but he said, of course, he would want to sign pro-life legislation if he were elected president.
And the next day, DeSantis, who was still in Iowa, said, of course, he'd consider Kim Reynolds as a possible vice presidential candidate. He was asked that question. He was never going to say, no, of course, I will not consider her.
Well, and the governor she has attended his events. She was at about a couple of weeks ago, a week and a half ago, she was at the rollout for the Mamas for DeSantis with Casey DeSantis, the First Lady of Florida. So the governor's former chief of staff and very close political advisor, Ryan Koopmans, is working for a PAC that's aligned with the DeSantis campaign. So even though Governor Reynolds is officially neutral in the caucuses, I think it's generally perceived that she has a favorable view of DeSantis, certainly.
Meanwhile, Vivek Ramaswamy said he believed the Democratic Party would ditch President Biden if their nominee was Ramaswamy. The Republicans nominated him, Ramaswamy. I don't think that's going to happen, that he would get the nomination. I doubt that the Democratic Party would ditch President Biden. But he also made news when he just ripped apart Republicans for their stance on Ukraine. He very much does not want to be there.
No, and I just have to say, I have to just put my media criticism hat on a little bit. Tucker Carlson, in interview, when you're at a forum like this, and I have moderated at some candidate forums, really the interviewer should try to be roughly neutral toward the various candidates. But it was very clear that three of the candidates got almost all favorable softball questions, DeSantis, Vivek Ramaswamy, and Tim Scott, the senator from South Carolina. And then the other candidates got more negative questioning. So Vivek Ramaswamy, very against U.S. military aid to Ukraine, as is Tucker Carlson. So they spent a long time talking about that and how that was a big mistake. And we should be deploying our military to the southern border of the U.S. and on and on. And so Tucker Carlson really, I mean, he didn't ask Vivek Ramaswamy any tough questions at all.
Ramaswamy received a standing ovation from the crowd after his comments on Ukraine, but former Vice President Mike Pence was booed after he said that anyone who says we can't be the leader of the free world and solve our problems at home has a pretty small view of the greatest nation on earth. We can do both. Pence has always had that stance on Ukraine, and boy, the crowd did not like that.
Well, and I mean, generally, Tucker Carlson, I mean, he started the interview with Pence in kind of an adversarial way, asking him about January 6th, which obviously for the people who are diehard supporters of Donald Trump, they view what Pence did on January 6th very negatively. He moved into Ukraine and he was kind of relentless on that questioning. I think it was obvious that the audience was more in agreement with Tucker Carlson's view than Mike Pence's. And he really didn't give Mike Pence a lot of opportunity to talk about the issues that he wanted to bring to the table. He wasn't asking him about abortion. Mike Pence has been a staunch opponent of abortion. I mean, he had to bring it up himself near the end of his time, whereas right at the beginning of Ron DeSantis's time, Tucker Carlson gave him an opportunity to talk to the crowd about abortion. So I felt like it seemed like things were stacked a little bit against the former vice president.
And as you say, there were other candidates there, Tim Scott, South Carolina, former Governor Nikki Haley, former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson. They all got time to speak. One person who wasn't there, the big guy who wasn't there, former President Trump, who had been invited, but he declined.
He declined. He sent Kari Lake, the former candidate for governor of Arizona, in his stead, and they requested that a surrogate be allowed to speak, but the family leader said no, they don't allow surrogates to speak. This was just for candidates. So Kari Lake was there, though. She was working the crowd, and there were other people there who were close to Donald Trump. I believe Mike Lindell was there, a big election denier, 2020 election denier. So they were definitely working the crowd.
Mr. Lindell is also, you have failed to say this, the pillow guy.
The pillow guy, yes.
And Kari Lake, as you know, believes she is the governor of Arizona.
That's right. And I mean, Tim Scott, like I said, very softball questions all the way. And Nikki Haley got, again, mostly favorable questions. Maybe she got one or two tough ones. Asa Hutchinson, I mean, right out of the gate, Tucker Carlson, very hostile, asked about the issue that would probably put him on the worst footing with the family leader audience. And it was just a very adversarial time. So I just felt like when you're organizing an event like that, if it was designed to be educational and not political, that certainly wasn't the way it came across to the viewer.
And Trump may have declined to come to the family leadership conference, but he's coming to Cedar Rapids on Tuesday for a televised town hall event on Fox News, not with Tucker Carlson. He no longer works on Fox News, but with Sean Hannity.
Yes, and I should say that Tucker Carlson was invited to be the MC of this event before he was fired from Fox News, but they did keep him on the program. I'll be interested to see what happens at this town hall. Trump's town hall ratings have not been as high this year as they were previously, so it'll be interesting. But I think that he's had a bit of a bruising week here in Iowa, so I expect him to come out swinging probably against Ron DeSantis.
Meanwhile, there's a new Iowa mailer that went out last week, and you reported on this. You've been the leader on both of these mailers in terms of reporting it. It's this a new group, who is trying to imply to Republican people, Republican voters, that Donald Trump is a trailblazer for transgender people.
Yeah, which is kind of laughable, honestly. As President Donald Trump tried to ban transgender people from serving in the military, and during this year's campaign, he has said he would ban gender-affirming care nationwide at any age. So you really could not call him, truthfully, a trailblazer for trans rights. But the second mailing that went out over the weekend is very similar to the first one. It raised the fact that in 2012, a transgender participant in Canada was allowed to participate in a Miss Universe contest. There was some comments in 2016 when North Carolina was facing some economic boycotts over its bathroom bill. There were some slightly negative comments from Trump that were quoted in this mailer. And generally, this is a brand new group. Nobody knows who's financing the group. There are other groups that are putting their name on mailers criticizing Trump. Americans for Prosperity, which is a Koch-funded group, they have sent out multiple mailings to say Trump can't win the election. He would lose to Biden. He would take down the whole ticket. But it's very interesting that these, I call it almost a false flag operation, these mailings that purport to be praising Donald Trump for his support for LGBTQ rights, that is no established group wants to put their name on that. That's a brand new group that was just incorporated a few weeks ago.
And there was more fallout from Trump's criticism of Governor Reynolds last week. Among them, a new 30-second spot from the Republican Accountability PAC that's going to be airing in Iowa, where a narrator says, this is a television spot, that Republicans love Governor Reynolds and then rips Trump for ripping Governor Reynolds.
Yes, and this is a post that Donald Trump posted on his Truth Social site where he criticized, he claimed that he doesn't invite Governor Reynolds to his events, which I kind of doubt. He claimed that he was responsible for her getting elected initially in 2018, which I think nobody involved in Iowa politics believes that. And last week, there was an effort by the Trump campaign to smooth things over. They apparently bought lunch and dinner for the Republican legislators during that special legislative session. But he is definitely, I heard a lot of talk about how he didn't help himself by criticizing Governor Reynolds last week. And this is something that Donald Trump has done for years. I mean, he tends to get angry and lash out at people. So it's not really new that this is how he relates to people, but it is new that he's doing it against the governor of Iowa as opposed to the governor, say, of Georgia, who he's attacked many times.
And very quickly, a first-term Republican Iowa state senator announced he is withdrawing his endorsement of Trump and giving it to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. I'm not sure that particular move is going to make a big impression on Iowa voters.
I don't think so. I mean, Jeff Reichman, he represents the area that includes way down the southeast corner, Burlington and Keokuk. And he had endorsed Trump earlier in the year. He said he was switching basically because he felt that the former president had insulted Governor Reynolds. I've been trying to ask the Shannon Lundgren, who's a state representative from the Dubuque area. She was also a Trump endorser. She wrote a newspaper editorial endorsing Trump in May. And then she posted something very critical on Twitter over the weekend saying that this is definitely going to hurt Donald Trump's campaign, that he criticized Governor Reynolds. And I emailed her to try to find out whether she is also retracting her endorsement of Donald Trump. Have not heard back from her.
And very quickly, the big kahuna in terms of the gatherings of Republican candidates going to take place July 28th at the Iowa Event Center in Des Moines. It's the annual Lincoln Dinner. And if it comes together, former President Trump and Ron DeSantis are going to be together for the first time in Iowa.
That's right. And they invited everybody. The Iowa GOP had a very open door policy. So your favorite, Dennis, Ryan Binkley is going to be there. Doug Burgum, the North Dakota governor, lots of people, Larry Elder. I think Will Hurd, who's the former U.S. representative from Texas, I think this will be his first Iowa visit as an officially declared presidential candidate. So lots of people on the program. I imagine they will probably save Trump and DeSantis for last so that people don't leave before the event's over.
And let's not forget the Iowa State Fair, August 10th through the 20th. Governor Reynolds announcing that she's invited all the GOP presidential candidates to join her in one-on-one conversations at the fair.
Well, and I thought this was an interesting power move by the governor to maybe sideline the Des Moines Register. The Des Moines Register has been running a political soapbox at the state fair for decades. That's always been open to presidential candidates or other candidates for state or federal offices. And I wonder whether a lot of presidential candidates are just going to ditch the Des Moines Register's soapbox and only do the sit-down one-on-one interview with Governor Reynolds. I'll be watching for that.
Laura, I don't think you have to wonder about that. I think that's going to happen. Barbara.
Probably.
And that's exactly why the governor is doing it. She's not a fan of the Des Moines Register, shall we say.
No, she did not meet with the Des Moines Register's editorial board in either of her last two elections.
No. All right, very quickly here, a story I want to get in because this came out this afternoon. U.S. House incumbent, Iowa House congressional members, each, four of them, each of them topping $1 million in fundraising already this year. The election is not until next year. That's a lot of money for this time of the year, a year ahead.
It is, and this is one of the advantages of incumbency, is it's so much easier to raise money. And I looked at the Federal Election Commission quarterly reports for the first and second quarter. The second quarter ones are the ones that just came out. And one thing that's interesting is for all four of the Republicans, as you mentioned, they all have more than a million cash on hand. They're all raising more than half a million a quarter. And one thing, reason why they're able to do that is they're getting so much money from political committees and political action committees and from fellow House Republicans. For all four of them, I think the majority of their money didn't come from individual donations, but it came from political committees or PACs. And that's just one of the advantages of incumbency. And right now, to my knowledge, there are not declared candidates against either of the first three congressional districts, Miller Meeks, Ashley Hinson, and Zach Nunn. And I think it's daunting when you know that the incumbent already has such a big war chest.
And briefly, there will be challengers against 4th District incumbent Randy Feenstra. He has 1.5 million cash on hand. His one of those running again is going to be Ryan Melton, who raised all of $53,000 last year. Well, Feenstra raised nearly 3 million. You've learned there could be another Democratic candidate.
Yes, Ryan Melton confirmed around the 4th of July that he is going to run again against Randy Feenstra. And Dr. Jay Brown, he's an allergist based in Ames. He has lived in Ames for about 30 years, I think. He confirmed to me that he is leaning toward running. I just have to, in full disclosure, that his family and my family he grew up in the house literally next door to me. So that's how I had talked to him earlier in the year. I knew he was thinking about it. He has not officially declared, but he said he's leaning toward it. So it could be a competitive Democratic primary there in that 4th district. Of course, the 4th district being the most Republican-leaning district in Iowa by far.
And briefly, are you hearing any names who could be running against the incumbents in either the first, second, or third districts?
I have not heard names in the first or second district. In the third district, I know there are several people looking at it. Teresa Greenfield, who it was the Democratic nominee for U.S. Senate against Joni Ernst in 2020, is apparently taking a hard look at it. I think that the third district is the one that the Democrats have the best chance of winning, just the way the numbers work out there. And so the question is, it's always somebody who can run up the score in Polk County and do reasonably well, not lose by very lopsided margins in those rural counties. And Teresa Greenfield has been working for the USDA since she lost that 2020 election.
Laura, our time is up. I want you to have a great week, and let's do this again Monday night.
Absolutely. Plenty to talk about.
Always plenty. We are indeed out of time for this edition of Capital Week. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will be back here in the same time slot next week, and as usual, we are going to talk about everything interesting or important or even entertaining that take place in Iowa politics. There's a lot of that. As always, we hope you can join us. Thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it and we value it. Between now and next time, whenever that is, we hope you have a safe, healthy, and very happy week.